Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at some aquatic invasive species in our state to begin the program. Things like sea lampreys, zebra mussels, alewives, white perch are just a few of them. And we'll also look at the work being done to control them here in Wisconsin. And back with us once again, Tim Campbell. Tim's an aquatic invasive species outreach specialist with the UWC grant program. And as we talk with Tim, I hope you'll join in. Have you seen invasives in your favorite body of water? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Tim Campbell, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
See, you've been doing this work with invasive species for more than a decade, and during that time, how have the populations of invasives in our state changed, or have you seen changes in the populations?
So I would say we'd have more populations of invasive species as existing population or existing species, like say zebra mussels, have slowly invaded some new lakes. But we do know from work funded by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative in the early 2010s that kind of that rate of invasions isn't really increasing. It's a pretty steady number, and that's not what we would expect with kind of what we know about how invasive species move across the landscape. So that's a good indicator that all of the prevention things that we're doing here in Wisconsin are having an impact and helping us, at least manage the problem and do some positive things with invasive species.
Yeah, well, which are probably the biggest offenders for us?
So as an aquatic invasive species specialist, if it flies or has roots in dirt, dry dirt. That's not something I think as much about. But for the aquatics, we spend a lot of time thinking about zebra mussels. When we get new populations of zebra mussels inland, that's usually pretty noteworthy. Starry stonewort, an invasive macroalgae that looks a lot like a plant, is something that a lot of us are concerned with here in Wisconsin, even though it's not in as many lakes. Those are probably the two that I've spent. New Zealand mud snails as well, as they've started to pop up in some
mud
of the trout streams in southwest Wisconsin.
Hmm. Chris in Black Creek has a question for you. Let's go there. Chris, hi.
Oh, good day, guys. Yeah, I've seen, I'm sure you have too, your guests, where a lake can get taken over by seaweed. I'm not sure if it's if it's a natural one for our area or not, but it'll cover the lake. And so when they use is it a chemical or is it a natural like poison or breakdown of the seaweed that they clear the lake with? And does that affect the fish? And should I eat the fish? Thanks.
Hmm. Great question. And with I think what we're talking about here is kind of this, aquatic plant management more mm-hmm. generally, which both includes invasive and non-native species as well as nuisance native species. So for any given lake, it could be an invasive species that is, an invasive plant that's kind of taking over the lake, or it could be a native species that just right conditions and has become kind of at nuisance and problematic levels. And there's a bunch of different ways that you can control those plants, whether it's herbicides, mechanical control. You've probably seen like the aquatic plant harvesters, like on Lake Mendota or something like that. But then there's also just like manual removal and like scuba divers that go out there and pull these plants. So there's a bunch of different methods that can be applied and are kind of suitable for specific populations and lakes. So it would really depend kind of what methods were used. And if the DNR is permitting these treatments as long as the treatments kind of follow the protocols of what the permit outlines. You know, things should be safe after that.
How have you seen people's responses to invasive species change over time? Is there more awareness out there?
Yeah, I think there's more awareness. Something we do in Wisconsin that not a lot of other states do is do regular surveys of our recreational boaters to see what their awareness, behavior, and knowledge is for invasive species. And we've seen that over time kind of just tick upwards. When I started in 2011, it was already pretty high, but thanks to a lot of work done by Sea Grant, Extension, the DNR, local county partners doing invasive species education work, you know, it's continued to tick upwards. So a study done by Cornell, at this point, I think it's, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, indicated that at least within the Great Lakes region, Wisconsin boaters were among the highest in terms of knowledge and self-reported behaviors for invasive species prevention.
You know, just think, what's the connection between invasive aquatic species and the health of our native plants and animals?
I like to think of kind of the impacts of aquatic invasive species as, you know, like another stressor on the things that we like about our lakes and rivers, or, you know, the plants and animals in those waters that we like. And so with every new aquatic invasive, we don't always know exactly what's going to happen when it gets into a new body of water, but that's another stressor on walleye populations or, you know, like water clarity, or, you know, these things that we care about. And it changes the system, so it really makes it more difficult to manage. So that's why we like to invest a lot of money in trying to prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species, because we all like having these experiences that we enjoy. We have memories of going fishing on, you know, some lake in northern Wisconsin and, you know, catching a giant muskie or whatever that memory is. Preventing the spread of aquatic invasive species, you know, I think makes it easier for us to continue to do those things in the future.
Yeah. Mary Kay from Kenosha has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have four suggestions. The first one is, why don't we reintroduce the weed cutters on our lakes? Also, restock oysters and restock with more fish. And those small gasoline-powered machines that are on the lakes, they need to get permits.
All right. Mary Kay, thanks for calling. You can address some of this, I'm pretty sure, Tim. Go ahead.
Yep. And I think depending on like what like aquatic plant harvesters are present or what's being used on the lakes, it's difficult to have kind of blanket, I guess, rules and regulations or like permitting for what's being used. So I think I'd be really interested in like what lake or set of lakes that we're thinking about here, and then trying to work either within the lake organization, a lake association, lake district, to help maybe look at either some lake specific rules, and then work with your local DNR lakes biologist to help look at different aquatic plant management techniques, because there is funding available through the DNR and through other mechanisms like funding through a lake district that could help fund some of those things.
She mentioned restocking oysters. I was thinking back to lampreys and what back in the day we did to sort of cut back on the populations, which was reintroduction of some salmon to Lake Michigan, for example.
Yeah, I think thinking about freshwater mussels in the upper Mississippi, I don't know a ton about them, but I do know that, you know, the upper Mississippi is kind of a hotbed for freshwater mussel diversity, you know, in the country and the world. And so I think they're really cool animals, and anything we can do to, you know, promote more freshwater mussels in our lakes and rivers and kind of manage for those animals, I think that'd be a welcome addition to our lakes and rivers.
Yeah. What's one of the, there's a definite impact on the economy, or can be, for some of these invasive aquatics. I'm thinking zebra mussels. Maybe talk about how the economy is affected by invasives.
So there's big numbers out there in peer-reviewed literature, depending on how you slice things. You know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars for aquatic invasive species in the Great Lakes for an economic impact, a negative economic impact, or $120 billion for both terrestrial and aquatic invasive species in the U.S. So those are obviously like really big numbers that are tough to kind of understand and wrap your head around. But I think if you think about more specifically, say like Lake Michigan and how zebra and quagga mussels have impacted, or you know, sea lamprey have impacted kind of the fishery there and changed the ability for people to go on a perch charter, since that's tougher to do with the presence of zebra and quagga mussels, and just how people might be spending their money because of how invasive species have impacted what people can do. I think that's a really good way to start thinking about that. Or you know, if you had a favorite beach that you enjoyed going to but is now covered with zebra mussels and algae, you know, the businesses around that beach probably aren't doing as well anymore because people aren't going to that beach because of the mussels and the algae. So sometimes it's a little easier to think about some of those impacts in that local level and how invasive species might be changing people's behavior and impacting local communities.
The Sea Grant program is involved in preventing the spread of aquatic invasives, of course. Let's talk about the statewide efforts that you're involved with.
So we, within Wisconsin, we are really lucky to have a really robust aquatic invasive species program statewide. And so within Sea Grant, we work both at the, well, we work at a county level with Scott McComb, who's our Southeast Wisconsin AIS coordinator. He covers Kenosha, Racine, and Milwaukee counties, working on implementing these DNR and university programs like Clean Boats, Clean Waters, our boater education program that people are really familiar with. Snapshot Day, one of the largest collections of community science data in the state every year. Citizen Lake Monitoring Network, which trains people to go out on lakes to look at different physical and chemical characteristics of their lakes, including invasive species. So that's something we do at a local level. You know, statewide, we work with the DNR and UW Extension to help implement new prevention programs. We create outreach materials that everyone across the state can use, like educational videos, things like that. And then we're also working at a regional, national scale, coordinating with the Great Lakes region, making sure that kind of all of our projects are aligned and we're creating similar programs across the Great Lakes as well as nationally, since we're seeing a lot more connections between like Great Lakes states and Western states and the transport of invasive species there.
Tim Campbell, our guest today, aquatic invasive species outreach specialist with the UWC grant program. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa is our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. You can join us Wednesday night at 7 for a rebroadcast of this week's Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate. Former Supreme Court Justice Dan Daly and Judge Janet Protasiewicz participated in the State Bar of Wisconsin's the debate on Tuesday. And you can hear the rebroadcast Wednesday night at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about aquatic invasive species with our guest today, Tim Campbell, who is an outreach specialist with the UWC grant program. They've got some programs going on to deal with some of the issues associated with aquatic invasives, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas at WPR.org. And Steve emailed us. He said, I had a more basic question. What invasive species are you most afraid will arrive in Wisconsin?
I really do not want silver or bighead carp to end up in the Great Lakes. They are present in the Mississippi River and tributaries up to the first dam. But, yeah, I really do not want silver or bighead carp because that's just not an experiment we want to run, because I think there's a lot of really valuable fisheries and recreational opportunities and commercial and recreational fisheries that silver and bighead carp could have a really negative impact on. So I really don't want that to happen. So I'm happy to see all of the different efforts done by our other Great Lakes states to make sure to, you know, keep them out of the Great Lakes.
I think you're spot on there, Tim. I would agree with you on that for sure. Peter in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I haven't heard much about rusty crayfish. What is their status these days?
I think that while there's still something that we're concerned with, we don't want them moving around. I think we're starting to see research that, you know, after maybe an initial population boom after their establishment, especially in northern Wisconsin, we've seen some fish better adapt to eat them and kind of their population levels or their populations level out. I know there was a paper recently published on this that looked at some long-term trends of crayfish populations in northern Wisconsin. And in classic academic fashion, I read like four sentences of the abstract and then I was like, I'm going to read this later. So I can't tell you everything that they found, except that I think things have kind of stabilized. So they're still present. They can still cause some impacts. We don't want them moving around. But it does seem like, you know, given the 20 or 30 years, well, longer than that, that people have been kind of researching them, you know, things have kind of stabilized a little bit.
Peter, thank you so much. Jim in Ellsworth, we move to you next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. So you brought up the New Zealand mud snails, and I don't know that they're people in Wisconsin are very familiar with them. I've heard that like the American River System in Sacramento has a big problem with them, and I've also heard they're extremely hardy and will live on waders for a long period of time for trout fishermen, and that's one of the ways they can be spread around. So just wanted to have you give more of a background on them and, you know, what the problem is here in Wisconsin, where they're located, and what people should do to try to reduce potential for their spread.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Tim, what do you think?
So New Zealand mud snails are a small snail. They are grazers, so they'll eat algae on, like, rocks or anything else in streams. And out west, they've been known to be a really big problem because they can be really abundant. So, like, you're just stepping on, you know, big colonies of snails as you're walking through streams. And that's not very pleasant, kind of takes away from the whole trout fishing aesthetic. But what they're doing is they're outcompeting the native aquatic insects for food. And so they can impact those macroinvertebrate levels, which then looks at or then can impact the food that trout eat, and the snails themselves are not great food. And so we don't have a lot of populations of New Zealand mud snails in Wisconsin. They have been present in some Great Lakes harbors for quite a while, but it wasn't until around 2014 that they were found in Wisconsin inland in Black Earth Creek. And they've been found in a couple of other trout streams within Wisconsin. And our streams tend to be really productive, so they could have a lot of really good habitat for New Zealand mud snails. So we're concerned that they could have a pretty strong impact here. So things that anglers can do to prevent their spread is to clean your waders. So if you get like a boot brush every time you go fishing, once you're done, scrub your boots to make sure that you're getting rid of any plants, animals, mud, debris on your boots. There are some like chemical treatments you can use, like Formula 409 is a pretty common one that's suggested, but you know, I think scrubbing your boots and letting them dry as long as possible is something that everyone should be able to do and can be pretty effective. And really, it's not just anglers. It's, you know, anyone accessing these streams. You know, if you're getting in like Black Earth Creek for whatever reason, you should be sure to clean your footwear and dry your gear as long as possible before moving.
Jim, thank you again for calling. Adam in Brookfield will go to you. Hi, Adam.
Yes, hello. I'm going to try to explain an experience that I had just to give you some background. I'm developing a wind turbine, and I made this really large part of the turbine, about 12 feet in diameter, and I put it on a trailer, and I was testing it. What I noticed was when I would go by a farm, the horses, the cows, the dogs were running and really fearful before I even got there. And what I realized was this turbine was making an ultra low frequency sound that was really powerful because of the size of it. And the animals all knew I was coming before it came along. And what it made me think of with the fish that are invading from the rivers in Illinois, has anybody experimented or has a theory about ultra low frequency sound effects on fish?
Wow, Tim, are you aware of any?
Yes, I am. I can't speak to all the specifics of the research, but that's a great observation. And that is something that the USGS and other researchers have been looking at within the Upper Mississippi River region to try to deter carp from either expanding their range in the Mississippi River or to get into the Great Lakes. So there are people that, I don't know if they've looked at super low frequencies, but people have been looking at light barriers, sound barriers, bubble barriers, all to keep carp and other fish from moving. And so can't speak to the specifics of that research, but I do know that people are looking at it and it does seem to show some utility in like preventing carp from moving through, say, a boat lock or something like that.
Interesting. Adam, thanks again. Appreciate it. Tom in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I am concerned about fishing tournaments that come up the Fox River in Green Bay, or actually all over the country, but they come here with their boats on the trailers back into the water, and then they take off, and next couple of days they're in Ohio or someplace else. Is there anything that can be done to stop the, the transportation of invasive species inside boat trailers?
And relating to fishing tournaments, well, to any, I suppose, but he's asking about fishing tournaments, but there is some work on that, Tim.
Yes. So the good thing about looking at AIS prevention with fishing tournaments is that all of the same things apply to them that would a normal boater. You know, if they pick the plants off and drain the water, that's a big help in preventing the spread of invasive species. I do hear the point of it's a lot of boaters, and sometimes they're traveling, with like overnight to go pre-fish for a new tournament. So this is something that Sea Grant in Wisconsin and across the Great Lakes has looked at in terms of fishing tournaments. We had about 5 years worth of work on this topic, working with large national fishing tournaments to implement AIS prevention measures. And something that we learned from our conversation with the tournament anglers is that, they're almost all on board with invasive species prevention because they know that preventing the spread of invasive species is important to their livelihood or the enjoyment of their hobby in tournament fishing, that invasive species could severely impact what they like to do. So most of them are already doing it, but there are ways that tournament operations can look at cleaning their gear to make sure that that the operations themselves, like the fish handling containers, aren't moving invasive species, and ways that the tournaments can kind of institutionalize some of the AIS prevention. They can add cleaning stations and kind of just generally promote the AIS prevention activities. And then there's also ways through like the permitting of tournaments as well that can help promote some of these activities, and sometimes they can be conditions of the permit as well.
Tom, thanks. Again, appreciate it. Tom in Bellevue, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
I have a question about when they bring in a species from someplace else, like the beetle that was brought in to control purple loosestrife, and now I guess there's a wasp they brought into the East Coast to control emerald ash borer. How do they make sure that it's not going to become a problem with something else?
Yeah, that's a big question. Good question, Tom. Tim, what do you think?
So I feel really good about any biological control mechanisms that are brought in, just from my understanding of the rigorous science that is done to make sure that they won't be a problem. And so for like the purple loosestrife beetle, Brock Woods, who recently retired from UW Extension, spent his whole career working on the purple loosestrife beetle, trying to understand how, like to ensure that that beetle only fed on purple loosestrife and that it didn't go to any other plant and negatively impact it. And so I think, you know, where maybe 50 years ago, we wanted to be mostly certain that nothing bad would happen, I think we are like as certain as we possibly can be now when we're bringing over biological control mechanisms to make sure that they are focused on what the problem is and don't spread anywhere else.
Yeah. Tom, thanks. Mike in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. I was just wondering what your guests thought about wave runners, you know, these wake boats that, especially on shallow lakes, my understanding is they tear up the bottom pretty nastily, and I'm wondering how that helps spread invasive plant species.
So disturbance can create space for invasive species, or, you know, just like anything new to come colonize that, whether it's, you know, a native species already present in the lake or some opportunistic invasive species. So yeah, when there's some disturbance there, there is space for something to come in and colonize that. In terms of the actual watercraft themselves, they do have, you know, some, or I guess like a unique aspect to their prevention that since they run on jet propulsion, there's extra water held in the engine that you need to be sure to clear out when you remove the boat from the water. So I think it's just running the engine for an extra second or two to make sure that it spits out all the water. So then that way you're not moving like zebra mussel veligers or spiny water fleas or something that could be found in the water. But otherwise, you're just, you know, picking the plants off, letting it dry. The things you would do for a normal boat also do a good job of removing the invasive species.
Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. You could join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org. Keith emailed us with a tip for killing those mud snails we were talking about a few minutes ago. He says you can... and he's a wader. He's a trout fisherman, and he uses waders. And he puts the waders in the freezer at home for a day, and the cold will, you know, it's 24 hours. The cold's going to kill the snails. But he, another comment is, if he forgets his wife, asks, what are those waders doing in my freezer again?
Yeah, so great if you have a large freezer or an extra freezer to freeze them. That's a great prevention method and something that we usually like to promote because it's something most people can do and it doesn't harm your gear. Most the chemicals you can use, like generally at the concentrations that you're using them, shouldn't impact your gear. Mm-hmm. But if you want to be extra certain that whatever prevention method you're using is not going to impact your gear at all, you know, putting your gear in the freezer for 24 hours or, you know, overnight is a great way to kill the mud snails.
Tiffany emailed and wonders, is there anything an individual homeowner with lakefront property can do to help decrease the invasive zebra mussel population on our lake? They live on Lake Sherwood in Nakusa, Wisconsin, and the zebra mussels are getting so bad they frequently cut their bare feet when walking around in shallow water. They cling to sticks and pine cones submerged in the water and so forth.
Unfortunately, I'm not sure that I have a great suggestion for what an individual homeowner can do to impact the zebra mussel populations. That's kind of one of the unfortunate things about invasive species is that once they're here in really high populations, it's tough for us to control some of them, especially zebra mussels. But one thing I can point you to, like something that you can do that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with zebra mussels, is the Wisconsin DNR and UW Extension's Healthy Lakes Program. And it's a small grants program for waterfront property owners and lake organizations to do small lake improvement projects at kind of the single property owner or like a small scales. And so there's a number of things that you could do that you could get a small amount of funding for, like putting in a rain garden or like other shoreline improvements that would just make your lakefront property a little nicer place to be. So while you might not be able to directly impact the zebra mussels, you might be able to get some help to do other things that could improve your lakefront.
And how do you find out more about that program?
I think it's healthylakeswi.org, but I can verify that right now. Yep, it's healthylakeswi.com.
Healthylakeswi.com. Tiffany, that's a good place to go. Zebra mussels, once they're in a lake, and I imagine they got into Lake Sherwood on somebody's boat.
Yeah, they're being transported either directly on people's boats or what's really common in the Great Lakes region is attached to plants that are attached to boats.
Oh, okay. So that's where you're going to more likely you want to make sure then as a boat owner, and I've been a boat, I've owned boats pretty much all my life and always have done as good a job as I could of cleaning the boat off and making sure I got rid of those weeds that are attached to the trailer. That's where you wind up with a whole lot of weeds when you pull out of a lake.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to key in on what you said, Larry, is doing as good of a job as you can do. It's tough to be perfect because we know that there's like little tiny pieces of plants that get stuck between like the rollers or the bunks, or sometimes you can't see everywhere on the boat. And it would be great if you can get those things, but it's also great that you did as good of a job as you could, because if you can get rid of 98 or 99% of stuff on your boat, odds are that, the stuff like what's left will dry out, or, it's going to be a week before you go boating again. So that greatly reduces the risk. So don't think that you need to be perfect to have an impact. Like if you do a good job and as good as you can do, that will have really positive impacts for Wisconsin's waters.
Nationally, you're involved in an effort to develop more inclusive names for invasive species. Tell us why that's a necessary project.
So something I've really been tuned into from some Sea Grant collaborators is that, better language and better naming convention just isn't more inclusive, which is like a good, worthy goal. It's also just better. As we look at new invasion pathways and we're engaging new communities outside of just recreational boaters, we might need different language to help draw people in as to why preventing the spread of invasive species through gardening or religious ceremonies is important. And as we look at names, sometimes names are, they could just be problematic based off of who they're named after or, if it's a place-based name, it doesn't really tell us as much about the invasive species as we think it does. It maybe tells us where it's from, but some work by some colleagues at Oregon Sea Grant has shown that a lot of times place-based names aren't really accurate. They either, like the North American signal crayfish, for example, you might think that that's present across all of North America, but it's present in one watershed in Northwest or in the Pacific Northwest. So that's not really super accurate. And so names that have like descriptions of either what the species looks like or what it does can be better in terms of managing invasive species because it can help people identify what that species is.
Like golden clam versus Asian clam.
Yep. Asian clam, yes, it is present in Asia, but it's also found in other places in the world where if we call it golden clam, you know, that it's pretty reliably brown and gold, and that can help people identify it.
Makes a lot of sense. So just to summarize it up, Dan, or to conclude, you gave some advice to one of the homeowners who had emailed us about what she could do in her lake. What, I mean, just in general, what can people do?
So if you're out, you know, if you're a recreational water user, you're boating, you're fishing, you get your feet wet, just make sure that you're picking the plants off your boat, you know, removing any mud, animal debris. So just getting all of the stuff off of you and your equipment as much as possible, and then draining any water from your boat or equipment, and then letting it dry as long as you can. So if you've been boating for a while, you've probably heard clean, drain, dry. Like that's the classic guidance that hopefully people can remember. But as you start to like look at other kind of pathways of invasive species, if you're a gardener, you know, you're interacting with live animals through the food trade or something like that, just be aware of what you're purchasing and understand that, you know, there are prohibited and restricted species and that, you know, like you as a consumer can make good choices to buy non-invasive, you know, plants or animals and those sorts of things.
Tim, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Larry.
Tim Campbell is Aquatic Invasive Species Outreach Specialist with the UW Sea Grant Program, and I expect at some point we'll have him back again. But we're going to turn our attention now to the enigma of phosphorus. There's a new book out. It's called The Devil's Element, and our guest, I've interviewed him before, Dan Egan, coming up next. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Larry Mealy.